as it often happens, you have to go to a conference to find out the latest that's happening in our division. So that was great. No surprise. Thank you for attending today, and I am following like a great set of presenters, so it's working out well that we kind of broaden out again to think about implementing violence prevention strategies or evidence-based strategies in violence prevention, and some of what we've been working on and thinking about in our division. No disclosures, and this doesn't officially represent CDC's views, so I feel very liberated by that. So basically, I mean, you've just heard from Alan, and he's pointed to the different areas of violence prevention. And can everyone hear me? Okay. Different areas of violence prevention that we work in, and I think we're doing more work in global violence now, in suicide, elder abuse. I think are the traditional things that we've worked in, child maltreatment, sexual violence, youth violence, and intimate partner violence. We really have a range of evidence-based interventions, so I would say just roughly speaking, we have more in youth violence, in child maltreatment, in terms of evidence-based strategies, fewer things in sexual violence and intimate partner violence or dating violence, although that's changing, I mean, that's emerging. One thing that I think is important that brought us to this project is really our mission at CDC, which we're reminded of often, and we're reminded of when we're not really meeting particular goals about making an impact on population-level violence outcomes. So, of course, one main strategy really is to implement population-level strategies, policies, regulations, passing laws that would actually impact structural and environmental factors that influence violence. That's certainly very important work, and it's, I would say, more developed in some areas of violence than others. But another huge area, of course, are behavioral interventions that actually have the potential to change social norms if they're actually implemented at a scale that also kind of reaches a population level impact. And that's a lot of the work that I do in the division, is thinking about scale up, or what I call spread. You know, what is, for us, the real-world context? We actually are a very small center within CDC, and our entire center budget is dwarfed by the program budget for some of our other HHS sister agencies, $1 billion that went out for home visitation to disseminate that, $500 million around teen pregnancy prevention. So part of what our group is really interested in the real world that we work in, you know, what are our assets, what can we really do to scale up? And I think, you know, what's clear is our biggest asset are our partners that we work with. And this doesn't represent everyone, but some of our core partners, in particular national organizations that we work with, like Futures Without Violence, our program grantees, and as well as our research grantees, like our injury centers that we fund, our youth violence centers, other government agencies and foundations. So we were really lucky in this case that Robert Wood Johnson was interested in working with us and funding us to do this work. I know they sort of come to the rescue of a lot of us. I'm looking at Cure Violence. They funded some of that work. And then we partnered with one of our big national partners, Futures Without Violence, particularly because of their work with coaching boys into men. And our interest really was in looking at real world implementation, not developing a study, a research study, to actually look at implementation, which is also an important area, but to really look at what's happening. So Futures is a big partner. Two main academic partners that we have, the University of Pittsburgh and also the University of Michigan. Pittsburgh because Liz Miller was the lead evaluator for Coaching Boys Into Men, and University of Michigan, Mark Zimmerman, who led the development of Youth Empowerment Solutions, which is actually implemented by all four of our STRIVE grantees, which are our youth violence grantees. And I see Krista in the room, who's with us, Linus. And then we also have other government agencies that we work with. And in this case, we partnered with the San Francisco Health Department, in particular the Parent Training Institute, because of their implementation of Triple P, which I'll talk about in a minute. And what we often learn about implementation are what all the barriers are due to lack of capacity, lack of funding, lack of time. We know that these are very common barriers. But what we actually found out in San Francisco is a very stable infrastructure for the implementation of this evidence-based intervention with a lot of TA and support and things that people would call the drivers of successful implementation. Okay, so just to sort of orient our study, what we basically came to think about is, again, getting back to the idea of spread, is that what's really represented in the literature, which would make sense because people who publish in the literature are often developers from academic institutions, and so their perspectives are often very well represented, but not so much implementers on the ground, or often when implementers or participants in programs, information is gathered from them, it's still sort of rendered in the view of a developer. And so we were really interested in getting sort of a full context of implementation, so implementers, participants, community stakeholders, as well as developers and TA providers. We knew from our review of the literature that people had really looked at adaptations and how evidence-based interventions are being adapted, and mostly what has been captured is what is considered lack of fidelity through adaptation. Also, sort of the frequency of certain types of adaptations, and to a much lesser extent, some folks have even actually tried to look at adaptations, which adaptations may influence outcomes, which is kind of hard to do. And I just want to clarify, what I'm talking about here are not full cultural adaptations of interventions that are then studied in the context of an effectiveness study or implementation study. We're really talking about things that are happening in the field, on the ground, once an intervention goes out, which is essentially how we disseminate interventions. We also wanted to further understand reasons for adaptations and which are really consequential. And the purpose of this is we spend a lot of time asking, for example, our program grantees to be documenting things that they change about the intervention, asking permission for those things, really trying to stick strictly to fidelity, even though that isn't always very well articulated. So we really had an interest in knowing which of these really matter and which can we really either may improve the intervention or at least improve the uptake of the intervention that we shouldn't spend so much time on. And then ultimately, where we came is to really try to understand the overall implementation environment and with a particular interest in feedback loops between stakeholders. Okay, so the qualitative study components, and I'm going to really laser focus in, but I just wanted to give you a snapshot. We selected these three interventions that represent work in child maltreatment. So Triple P is a positive parenting program, and Coaching Boys into Men you've heard about, and Youth Empowerment Solutions is considered to be, it is sort of a youth empowerment program, but also a community-level intervention intended to impact youth's relationship with their community, but also to contribute something positive. And so we actually, what I want to talk about, I'm going to laser focus in on the implementers today, given the time. There are also other elements of the study itself with developers, TA providers, and a crowdsourcing project we have if there's time at the end. So for our data collection, we went to San Francisco and we talked with implementers from 19 different agencies, those implementing Triple P. Katrina has talked about the work that's been done in Western PA, so I won't reiterate that, but that's work that University of Pittsburgh did all of the data collection on that. We're working together on the analysis. And then Youth Empowerment Solutions, this was sort of a special, and I should have the Strive logo up here. We had a special opportunity because our Strive grantees all chose to implement YES, that we actually not only just sort of asked about adaptations, but systematically tracked the adaptations that were made during this first round of implementation, and there are two Strive grantees here for later for questions. All right. So I'm going to move right to some of the cross-cutting things, some of the things that we learned from all of these. And I think similar to other work that's been done in this area, we came up with kind of these four main categories of adaptations. Things get added to content or activities or modified to content or delivery, shortened at times, and or skipping activities. But I think what we were able to add through the qualitative is that things that get added to or modified are often in direct response to participant needs or participant engagements, so adding different types of activities or scenarios or examples. But things that often get dropped or shortened are usually in response to settings, like the logistics, running out of time in schools. And I think this is important just in considering the actual uptake of interventions, that some of what's happening that people are adapting are actually trying to make it more relevant and engage folks. So I'm going to move through this rather quickly. I think I have less than 5 minutes left. But the other thing that we learn is that there's one reason that can lead to multiple adaptations. So with Triple P, one reason was the accessibility for parents with low literacy. And so input facilitators were doing a lot of things. They were repeating material. They were modifying reading activities because they weren't really helpful to parents. They added more role plays to actually bring the concepts into kind of a more concrete forum. And they modified the homework and simplified the handouts. And conversely, there may be multiple reasons for a single adaptation across this set of implementers in particular. So to increase the access for low literacy, engage parents, increase discussion overall of the group and ensure skills are reinforced, there was a lot of modification of the homework. So I think the overall idea here is there isn't just sort of a one-to-one relationship, that there's an overall ecology that people are implementing in, and these things are related. And what we actually found is there's a cascading effect. When people sort of shift one thing, then other things have to shift to actually make it work. Okay. So the other, a big thing that happens that I think has implications for even just developing interventions and the flexibility up front are bringing in real-life examples. So this Triple P implementer describes, you know, I think sharing my own experience builds that relationship between the facilitator and participants and kind of validates the work. It also gives real-world examples instead of just reading from the book. You're able to relate the material to real-life scenarios that maybe you've experienced with your own kids or other kids. And a similar idea coaches talk about is that they all took things from their own personal experience and tried to use that to get them to understand what we're trying to talk about. And so the idea is that they weren't really trying to vary what was in the curricula per se, but kind of bring it to life. Another idea, my colleague created this slide, and it just stuck. And it's just a whole other topic area to explore, but it's really important because it's not specific to any one adaptation. But a lot of what we learn is what we call sort of the implementer as a context, that implementer characteristics form the implementation context and influence probably more than anything. So, for example, we have coaches. Katrina talked a little bit about the difference between the coach and the DV advocate, but there's also a difference between a coach that's been there 30 years at the high school and one that's more of a near peer, that's closer in age, right, is willing to share experiences from his own life. There's one that was a guidance counselor and actually has a different role. So those kinds of things actually, over and above adaptations or sort of making specific adaptations, set the tone for implementation. And I think there's other examples from the other interventions about how people relate to youth, their values and beliefs, the types of interventions they've implemented before, all influence how they actually implement. So you could technically both implement an intervention, same intervention with fidelity, and actually see differences in how messages are received. So I'm sort of short on time to talk about feedback loops, but it kind of, to me, is the heart of our work, which is this idea of bringing of research to practice and the way that we think about it. And I can certainly talk about it more in the question and answer, but I want to respect the time. So our idea is, if you start with evidence-based interventions, the first thing is really the translation of that. so that practitioners actually have it in a usable format. Believe it or not, it doesn't always perfectly translate. And you can see some of the things that we actually did with YES, the YES developer and our Strive grantees. And so actually our Strive grantees helped when the developer started to develop core components documents. They provided input and helped refine actually what that looked like. So then there's the transfer and actually evidence-informed adaptations. And they tracked adaptations through these different methods, including conversations and feedback loops with the developer. We were lucky to actually be able to work with the developer. And then the developer actually made refinements to both the program as well as the materials to, like, describe the theory of change and the actual implementation materials. And I'd love to talk, and I think that in and of itself is something I'd love to talk about. But my time is up, so I'm not going to. So in conclusion, you know, I think what we found is, yes, adaptation happens. There's sometimes a debate if we ask about it, when we don't, or that we create barriers to that, which we do all the time through funding, then we don't learn about what's happening in the field. We actually learn about what people think is safe to tell us. Adaptation seems to influence uptake, but the question we always get is, what about outcomes? And I think, it's a whole other area of improving the ability to collect outcome data and be able to do things with enough reach that it matters. Fidelity and flexibility are further clarified in practice, so that isn't just sort of an academic exercise. And I don't mean to diminish it by saying this, but it's not something that's just in the realm of academia through the development of theory and empirical study, but is actually really clarified through practice and sort of made concrete. And finally, feedback loops between stakeholders may improve adoption and spread of evidence-based interventions. So that's some adaptation guidance we developed based on that and my email. So thank you very much.
Sorry. Great. Thank you, Kim. So we've got about 4 minutes left for questions that can go out to any of our presenters. If folks have any, you're welcome to ask them. Yes. So we're going to pull Kim back up to the microphone here. The question was about crowdsourcing.
Yeah, this is another one. I'm like, we should talk when I get back. Sure, and this is something actually Katrina will also be involved in, but we've contracted with a company. They what they refer to themselves as, they specialize in community-centered design, which in co-design, if you're probably hearing more about that now. And I think it's a sort of traditional health education term that's kind of been brought back into the business world and now kind of fed back to us. And the idea is that what we're doing now in the discovery phase is they've done interviews and surveys with coaches that are implementing Coaching Boys into Men. And then this month what they're doing are what they call co-design sessions with coaches. So coaches aren't just sort of the end user providing input, but they're actually working to co-design some prototypes of platforms that could bring them together. So obviously technology is part of them getting networked, but it's also part of developing a campaign when it's launched of other, whether it be in person. I mean, that's the whole idea of the discovery, is what is the best way to network coaches who are may have common goals but aren't necessarily networked outside of their district or a particular high school in some cases. So the idea is that we're going to look at that in terms of how that facilitates the spread of Coaching Boys into Men. We're going to try and develop it as a way to develop implementation data that really looks at, in real context, how are coaches implementing these different sessions, to be able to then call the ones that we could say, here's 20 ways like good implementation looks. So there's obviously some moderation that has to happen. And then also we're trying to look to it potentially as a way to collect outcome data at some point from coaches other than sort of traditional surveys. So that's a, does that, that's a long answer, but.
One more question. I'm just wanting to see more about the feedback loops, because we know there's inherent tension enablers.
Do you want me to reiterate the question? So basically, how these adaptations are changing, and then the differences with. I'm sorry. Can you say it again?
Yeah.
How the TA? Okay. So the question is around the TA and how there's some strict restrictions that also influence the implementer or how the program's actually being used, right? So I can only kind of empathize when I think about how our advocate is also the trainer. So our advocate trains these coaches to actually deliver the program. And then kind of what Kimberly's talking about with that implementation context. So it was hard because we had issues because the two high schools also rivaled in sports. So there was that issue. And then there was the issue that the coaches were like, well, your advocate is teaching at this other school that's our rival. So that was kind of a context issue. That was one thing. And then the other thing was that he held a different hat, right? So he was an advocate. He knew more about this expertise. And coaches, well, you're coming to kind of my territory. These are our kids. This is what we do. So the TA is the most important thing that we saw was that it was flexible. So from my hat as here's a large-scale clinical trial, you have to do it X, Y, and Z. I can't tell you how relieved I was doing this project because it was very much more, well, where do you want to take it? You know, I actually am not the expertise. I'm not someone who brings this. And our advocate was really good about developing those relationships with the coaches, saying, I'm just here to support you. So I'm not necessarily the only context expert. I'm actually here to also learn from you. I would love to come and observe from you. So it's always kind of that relationship development with anything to help bridge the gap where you're an expert in this, but so am I. So let's help each other out.
I would just have one quick thing to add to that, which is that we learned is to have multiple forums for people to communicate, because they'll tell, as you know, we tell some people some things, but we may tell others other types of information that, depending on the situation and the power dynamic and all of that. But what we found is if there's multiple ways for people to share, that we get at least a more complete picture. So that's just what you said.
Great. Well, thank you, everybody. Two quick housekeeping items before we adjourn. The first is out on the table just outside of this session, you'll find a list of other health communication sessions at the annual meeting. So if you're interested in these type of topics and others around health communication, you can pick up one of those schedules and it will list the other ones for you. And then secondly, I just wanted to thank our presenters again for taking the time to come here today and give their presentation. So if we can just give them a last round of applause.